Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 159 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Jim Jesernick Eyes the 2020 Washington Legislature with 2020 Vision. About my conversation with the Washington Grain Commission lobbyist during a break in the action at the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention held November 11th to 14th at the Grand Hotel in downtown Spokane. I waited until now, January 7th, 2020, to post our conversation because the 2020 Washington Legislature convenes January 13th. For those who understand how legislative actions in Olympia create powerful repercussions over agricultural interests, this episode is essential listening. I'll post a photo of Jesernick at our Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. While you're there, please follow the page and share the post with your friends. I've known Jesernick for a long time. As a young agricultural reporter, I would talk to him frequently when he was director of the Washington State Department of Agriculture. Although my knowledge of farming, not to mention the legislature, required frequent tutorials, he was always kind and patient. When I was hired at the Grain Commission, he went out of his way to welcome me as a colleague, telling the audience at a meeting we both attended that he remembered our interviews, and while I was tough, I always quoted him accurately. Then he paused and said, "But I wish I hadn't said some things." That got a big laugh and my appreciation. I've always been impressed by Jesernick because physically he's impressive. He's 6'5" with a hand that swallows mine when we shake. And although he's clean-shaven, there's something Lincoln-esque in his craggy looks. Also, like Lincoln, while he can be serious, he knows how to laugh. But Jesernick is not just some rugged facade. He's one of the smartest guys I know, and I believe this episode will convince podcast listeners of that fact, too. Jesernick and I spoke on November 13th in a meeting room at the downtown Spokane Grand Hotel. He came into our conversation cold, not knowing what I was going to ask, and then spoke for the next 30 minutes without notes about ongoing challenges as well as issues from more than three decades ago. Jesernick's recall, along with his experience at various levels of government, serve as invaluable tools in helping guide the WGC through the Olympia lawmaking process, not to mention his deep knowledge of state agencies that exert control over the industry. And then there's his ability to see the big picture and create consensus by helping like-minded agricultural groups find common ground. I begin our conversation by asking Jesernick to chart his professional career in and around the Washington Legislature.
This will be my 34th session coming up. I started back in, ran for office in 1986 and was in the House for 4 years, the Senate for 4 years, ran the Department under Governors Lowry, Department of Ag under Governors Lowry and Locke for 9, and then I've been lobbying for the last 14 or so. So in one capacity or another, I've been there every session since 1987.
Okay, so you're revealing yourself a little bit. Governor Lowry and Locke were both Democrats. Are you a Democrat?
Well, the D's have gone a little far to the left on environmental issues for my comfort level. I would say I'm kind of a born-again nonpartisan. I see a lot of good in individual legislators from both parties, but I see a lot of bad policy being driven from the parties themselves. So for me, it's more working with individual legislators on policy issues rather than identifying with any political party.
Is Eastern Washington losing its influence in the legislature?
Well, I would say yes and no. I mean, from this perspective, The yes is the number of legislative districts has shrunk over time. Way back when they first districted the state back in the 30s or 40s, there were 19 districts in eastern Washington and 30 in western Washington. There's 11 now in eastern Washington. It's going to drop to 10. So instead of 19 to 30, it's going to go 10 to 39, which is a big difference. And that's just demographics. That's just where the growth has been the I-5 corridor from Olympia to Everett. And that's where your legislature is going to be because you have to apportion it evenly. There have been and are some very good legislators from eastern Washington that help expand the influence of eastern Washington beyond just the number of legislative districts. You know, you look at Senator Schessler as the majority leader when he was in there, Senator Billig, who's now the majority leader. The last two majority leaders in the Senate have been from eastern Washington. So you have some good legislators, but you're kind of running out of districts. And after the next census, it is estimated that half of the legislative districts will be in King County alone.
Half in just King County.
Just King County.
Amazing, amazing. What's the breakdown right now between R's and D's in the legislature?
Well, what you've got in the Senate is a bit of a funny setup. It's actually 27-22, D's to R's, but you have a very conservative D in Tim Sheldon that caucuses with the R's, so it's kind of 26-23 in reality. But in 27-22 is the makeup, but 26-23 in reality. The House had been pretty close. It was 50-48 last time, but now it's down to 41-57. 41 Republicans, 57 Democrats. So you've got some pretty healthy Democratic majorities in the legislature as a result of the 2018 midterm elections, which followed the path of most midterm elections, having the party that is in the White House losing seats in both the Congress and state legislatures.
How many farmers are actually in the legislature?
One.
One.
Out of 147.
Uh-huh.
Senator Mark Schessler.
So what about if we include folks involved in the natural resource industries? I mean, does that bring the number up?
Oh, you get up to about three or four. Maybe five if you expand it a little ways. You have folks like Representative Brian Blake, who's a logger who got injured and, you know, has retired from that. But I would say it's a pretty small number reflecting the smaller numbers in the population as a whole.
Is this something that agriculture needs to be concerned about, or can we trust the legislatures to represent us even if they're not farmers?
I think you can have a legislature and legislators like Speaker Frank Chop, who didn't represent a ag district or wasn't a farmer, that can support agriculture. You do need to have farmers and legislators from farm districts that understand agriculture. That's very important, because then when you have issues that are difficult, like environmental issues, Snake River Dam issues, you know, policies like that are very controversial, they can bring some facts to bear inside the caucuses.
Okay, I wanted to ask you a question about Frank Chop. Now, he served as Speaker of the House since 2002, but he has retired. What is his legacy to agriculture?
Well, he's not really retired from the legislature. He's retired from being Speaker. So he's still going to be a House member. His legacy has been one of, for not just agriculture, but of all rural Washington, supporter of what he called One Washington, and it was built out of, one, his belief that One Washington was important, but two, a very deep relationship he built with Representative Bill Grant from Walla Walla, who's a wheat grower there, that I actually went into the legislature with. Unfortunately, Bill has passed away, but he got a very strong affinity for agriculture with that relationship. And we're worried about losing that with him stepping down as Speaker. For 20 years, it's clearly been, people have wanted to know where you stand in the House. The answer is, well, what does Frank think? And because he really did run the House of Representatives. That won't be the case now. You have Representative Lori Jenkins as your new Speaker-elect or Speaker-designate. Frank will still be there. but he just won't be the speaker. And then we'll see if he runs for re-election or not.
Well, what can you tell me about the new Speaker of the House? Where does she come down, liberal, conservative?
Representative Jenkins would, I think, see herself as a very liberal, progressive Democrat. Her focus is not kind of in the ag, the environmental area. That's not been in her kind of her wheelhouse. Her wheelhouse is more in the healthcare, mental health areas that she's worked in the past, and that's her focus. And so when she came in as speaker, there were a lot of people in the natural resource world that were concerned with, you know, would she understand and come up with a balanced approach to environmental issues? And to her credit, she has been out going around the state meeting with Democratic and Republican representatives to just learn more about the whole state. She's very smart. She was the chair of the Judiciary Committee up until becoming Speaker-elect. She's a very hard worker. And so, you know, we're a little more optimistic now that she'll see more of the One Washington like Frank did than we were concerned about. But for the most part, the natural resource industries, whether you're talking fishing, you know, timber, ag, any of those, hadn't worked with her in the past because her focus had been on other issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'd argue that the majority of wheat farmers in the state default to the idea that R's are good for agriculture and D's are bad for agriculture. Does that have a foundation in fact?
I think there's parts of it. It's more some of the D's tend to land on environmental issues that are problematic for ag rather than they're bad for them. You know, because the same Democratic legislator that would be a concern about water policy, say they want in-stream flows rather than agriculture, you know, being able to have water available to them, they may be also a big supporter of ag research at the same time. Republicans tend to be stronger supporters, especially in a lot of the environmental issues, whether you're talking riparian buffers, Snake River dams, issues like that. But you also have, with the moderates that are left in the legislature, in the Democratic Party, people like Representative Brian Blake, Representative Mike Chapman from up in the Port Angeles area, big supporters of agriculture in rural Washington as well. You've got to be a lot more specific to the legislator, I think, rather than kind of a carte blanche, you know, this caucus or that caucus is good or bad for agriculture.
Governor Inslee was running for president with a strong environmental point of view. Now he's announced that he'll run for a third term as governor of Washington. Does he have anything to prove, and do farmers have anything to fear?
Well, I think the issue is, are there policies that the governor would be proposing that could be really problematic for ag? And I think the answer is yes. There's some areas that ag is going to disagree with the governor on in this session coming up. It is a big deal that he announced, rather, that he's going to run for re-election, because then he's not a lame duck. And so people have to listen, because he's got to sign the bills that come through. He can line out and veto budget sections he doesn't like. So that changes, is a big dynamic change. I think the biggest one that we're concerned about is the governor is a huge supporter of the low carbon fuel standards. And the concern there is that's going to raise the cost of fuel. But the increased cost of fuel is not going to go into roads or bridges or transportation infrastructure. And so that's, you know, especially with the CARTABS initiative passing, there's a pretty big hole in the transportation budget right now. And if you then say, okay, we have that hole, but we're going to raise the cost of fuel with this new standards, there's not going to be much stomach to have any kind of a gas tax increase or some other type of a revenue source to try and fill the transportation infrastructure problem. So that, from a policy standpoint, I think going into this session, that would be the biggest concern farmers would have.
Okay. So if there's going to be some kind of carbon legislation, you know, in certain respects, I see farmers saying not no, but hell no. And on the other hand, it seems like it's coming. Do we need to get on board in order to have a role in how it's crafted?
I don't think there is a willingness to support any kind of a cap and trade, carbon tax, cap and invest. Senate Energy Environment Chair Senator Reuben Carlisle is going to have a proposal, as we understand it, that's essentially a cap and trade system, much like California. And I don't think there, under any scenario, there would be an agricultural support for those, whether they had a say in the outcome or not. Because if you don't support it, you're not going to have ability to say, here's what we think it should look like. At the same time, when ag is asked what makes sense, what doesn't make sense in this arena, we've given them all kinds of information to the people that are proposing it. So, for instance, not as much of a wheat issue, but a huge issue for the potato industry is the potato processing costs, because carbon tax could put $1.3 million on a processing plant, making it uncompetitive with a sister plant in Idaho or Oregon. So there are, you know, areas that you could have a focus where you're explaining to policymakers, if they want to limit the impact on agriculture, off-farm fuel, things like that, they may take them on. But I don't think there's ever going to be a stomach in agriculture to support that legislation in any form.
You just mentioned the initiative to reduce car tabs passed by a wide margin. Are you concerned what that means in terms of the legislature having to come up with other funding methods?
Well, I think it's not so much a concern as a reality. First of all, unless the court overturns 976, which it may or may not do, you have a pretty big hole in the transportation budget at not just the state level, but the county and city level as well. And for county roads in eastern Washington, that's a big deal. You're not going to overturn that legislatively. One, you'd need two-thirds votes of the legislature to do it within the first 2 years of an initiative passing. And secondly, anyone that has an initiative that passes in their district that they vote to overturn could get overturned themselves. So they're unlikely to support it. At the same time, they may look at other revenue sources. The usual one is a gas tax. It's just to increase the gas tax by 5, 10, 15 cents, whatever they want to do to try and raise it. Wildly unpopular as well, especially in light of possibly raising fuel prices that much with low carbon fuel standards. And then you put this on top, suddenly you're 30, 40, 50 cents a gallon higher, and the public will be unhappy with that. What the legislature and the state's looking at is this miles driven idea, and intuitively that makes some sense to have folks pay for the amount of miles they drive. But the technology to do it has got people and their concerns about privacy very, very high. I mean, I personally have a lot of concerns about having to say everywhere I've stopped, everywhere, anytime, anywhere. I'm stopping at a 7-Eleven, whatever. I don't want to have my whereabouts known by everybody. So I don't know how they're going to move on that. So I think they're going to eventually default to some kind of a gas tax increase to do something. So mm-hmm. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. What about an income tax?
Well, the income tax has generally been thought to be unconstitutional in the state of Washington, above a 1% income tax. So one of the proposals by some of the more liberal progressive Democrats is to pass a capital gains tax, which is a form of an income tax, and then get the issue in front of the legislature. The issue for the capital gains tax is that money, as most money that comes in from the sales tax or the B&O tax, goes into the general fund for the operating budget. The operating budget then pays the debt service on the capital budget. The part of the budget that's now got a big gaping hole in it is not the operating or the capital budget, it's the transportation budget. And the capital budget would be unlikely to be diverted over to fill a hole in the transportation budget. Mm-hmm. They would be looking at the transportation system to do that.
What does this decrease in funding mean for the short line railroads in the state and the state's support of those railroads?
Well, what's happening now to short line rail, but also to county, state, and other road projects is across the board, if they aren't already moving forward, are being put on hold because the state and or counties may have to redivert money to finish projects they've got. because that funding stream is not coming in to expand it. So whether it's short line rail or it's overpasses or intersections or roundabouts or whatever that's on the books for the state, counties, and actually cities in many instances, those are being put on hold pending a review of how you're going to prioritize funding if you're just going to be at a lower level.
You know, we used to call it soil quality, but nowadays they call it soil health, and it's taken a much higher profile in the state. What's happening and why?
Well, what's happening is there is a to back up a little bit. Soil health is a difficult – go back to my ag director days. Soil health in Washington State is very difficult. The reason it's very difficult is you got 250 to 300 different commodities, 100 of which you have a lot growing, 100 different commodities, and you got different geographies and different weather patterns. So it's not like Kansas. It's not like Oklahoma, where it's pretty simple to say, here's your soil health problems, and then you can kind of fix them. You have a soil health problem for a berry farmer in Whatcom County near Linden that's very different from a wheat guy down in Pomeroy. So what trying to get your hands around how does soil health work in the state of Washington is very complicated. There's an effort that's spearheaded by WSU, Derek Sanderson at the Department of Ag, and the Conservation Commission 2 years ago at the request of Governor Inslee to say, how can we have a comprehensive soil health initiative to be able to look at all of those different aspects, and where should we put our resources, whether on a soil pathology or, you know, pathogens, fertility, you know, where should we put our resources there? Because you do have a very robust soil health program or soils program, soil and cropping system program at WSU. How should we expand that? So what is now in play is the Department of Ag will have a piece of legislation putting that collaboration in statute, the Soil Health Initiative between the Department of Ag, WSU, and the Conservation Commission. And there are funding requests that are around $800,000 a year that WSU is pushing forward to increase some of the faculty and staff at different research stations around the state of Washington. What they're going to be trying to do is to move to the next level in soil health, which is goes beyond fertility, goes beyond chemistry, gets down into microbes and the biology. Because one of the problems you have is with some crops, potatoes for example, you can't crop them every year. You have to wait 3 to 4 years. That means you could actually, if you could do even 1 year less on that, you could pick up 20 to 30% more production, which could then export and produce jobs. They don't know a lot of times why one field produces better than any other. It's got the same soil health profile. They believe it's at the biology side of it, microbe level, don't understand it well. So that's the new frontier. So the Soil Health Initiative is an effort to come up with a comprehensive soil health focus for the state of Washington across all geographies, cropping systems and weather patterns, and focus the resources so we can have a very robust agriculture into the future, because every commodity's got a soil health issue, every commodity in every corner of the state, and we're going to need to have a focus on that to keep our farmers productive.
Washington State Department of Agriculture Director Derek Sanderson has had a really very hands-on approach to his job, and he seems very well respected. Does that matter when it comes to the legislature?
It matters not only in the legislature, but in Congress, with the administration, and within his own administration. Director Sanderson has done an incredible job as running the Department of Ag and being that spokesman for not only agriculture, but rural Washington, in the state of Washington, in the Congress, and in a group called the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture with his colleagues across the United States. So, you know, Derek's done a great job, and it makes a big difference in the legislature, because if someone comes into the legislature with a proposal that would be just devastating to ag, he's able to sit down and say, well, here's how it would really impact ag, and here's how you might be able to get your goal that wouldn't have that big of an impact. So You know, that's been incredibly helpful. And part of that is driven by his understanding of the Columbia Snake River hydropower system, water system, because, you know, for eastern Washington, the Columbia Snake hydropower system is a huge deal. You've got a lot of issues going on in the courts about it, and you've also got the U.S.-Canada treaty that's coming up. And I don't think there's a single person anywhere on the planet, actually, that understands that better than Director Sanderson.
Wow, wow. Jim, you have been involved in various capacities with the legislature for 34 sessions. How has the legislature changed over that period of time?
34 years ago, there was a lot more bipartisan problem solving, a lot more. What's tended to happen is that moderates within the Republican Party have been ripped, ostracized, kind of thrown out of the party by the far right within the Republican Party, and the moderates within the Democratic side of the aisle have been ripped up, spit out, chewed up by the far left in the Democratic Party and the politics around that. So what's happened is there are vastly fewer moderate Republicans and Democrats. You don't have the Dan Evans Republicans very much anymore. You don't have the Scoop Jackson Democrats. And I think that's very problematic. It mirrors what's going on in D.C., not nearly as viciously, but it becomes problematic because, like society as a whole, legislators are now becoming kind of an echo box and hearing their own news the way they want to hear it, hearing their side of the story all the time, and the inability to listen to the other sides and try to problem solve stuff is hurting. And I think that, you know, we're seeing it on the federal level in an ugly way. On the state level, it's become more like that. I hope it's not fatal to our system, but it could be if we don't work to try and come up with a little better way to work things.
I hope it's not fatal to our system either, but certainly compromise has become a dirty word on both sides of the political spectrum. I hope you enjoyed episode 159, or what I called Jim Jesernick Eyes the 2020 Washington Legislature with 2020 Vision, about my conversation with the WGC's man in Olympia. Please join me again next week for another episode of Weed All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our glue, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.